In this second hour of Midday, three stories about the African-American press. Biographer James McGrath Morris tells us about a reporter whose byline was once familiar throughout Black America, but whose work was largely unknown in white America. Ethel Payne was her name, known as the First Lady of the Black Press, an influential chronicler of the civil rights movement 50 years ago. We'll also speak with Irving Phillips Jr. and his son, Irving Phillips III, examples of their family's photography. Three generations capturing the African-American experience in Baltimore is on display at City Hall. And the Afro. How is the country's longest-running African-American family-owned newspaper doing in the digital news age? All that on Midday, after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks for joining us for the second hour of our show today. In this hour, three stories about African-American journalism. We'll meet Irving Phillips Jr. and Irving Phillips III and talk about their family's 70 years of photojournalism and photography, three generations capturing the African-American experience in Baltimore and beyond. And the Afro, the country's longest surviving family-owned African-American newspaper, published right here on Charles Street. It meets the demand for the digital news that's out there. Benjamin Phillips IV, president and director of global markets for the Afro-American newspapers, will be talking with us about the Afro and the Black press in the internet age. But our first guest is with us here now for this first segment of the show. Our first guest wrote his last biography about one of the best-known names in American journalism, Joseph Pulitzer, the Hungarian immigrant whose name adorns prizes awarded to the best examples of reporting, commentary, and photography each year. But for his latest book, James McGrath Morris chose a reporter whose byline made her a household name in the Black community and a motivating force in the civil rights movement, but a journalist whose work was never seen by 90% of Americans. That's because Ethel Payne wrote for the Chicago Defender, a powerful voice in news, politics, and culture for African Americans across the country, but one virtually ignored by whites in the segregated world of American journalism during the 20th century. In researching the book, James McGrath Morris says he discovered that white Americans paid little attention to what was reported in Black newspapers, particularly about civil rights. But Blacks were equally distrustful of what they read, heard, or watched in the white media. It's a distrust that persists well into the 21st century. Ethel Payne was a Chicago librarian who rose from obscurity to cover national politics, the White House, and international affairs as well during the 1950s and 60s. Ethel Payne viewed herself as much an advocate for civil rights as a reporter, and was unapologetic about that, even as a new generation of African-American writers steeped in the trappings of objectivity made its mark in mainstream newspapers, in television, and in radio. James Morris says that growing up as a State Department brat in a home of wealth and privilege, he initially found it hard to reconcile the difference between the way Blacks and whites viewed the world around them. That dichotomy was reinforced when he researched this book. Eye on the Struggle, it's called, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. The book was certainly an eye-opener for us because, like most white journalists, we'd never heard of Ethel Payne, I'll admit. Eye on the Struggle is available from Amistad, which is a
imprint of HarperCollins.
James Morris. Nice to have Jamie Morris, they call you.
Well, everybody calls me Jamie, so calls feel you, free to do that.
Jamie Morris is going to be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library tonight, so we get to spend a few minutes with him talking about Ethel Payne, who was a librarian and really didn't become a journalist, I think, till she was almost 40 or in her
40s.
She was
40. It's a real inspiration story for those people like myself when my father called me a late bloomer in life.
How did you get to this story?
I got to the story because I'd written a number of books on journalists, and you become typecast in this business. And so I went back and made a list of American journalists, and the famous ones like Walter Cronkite were already being done. Ethel Payne kept showing up on that list, but when I started researching her life and found it was such an extraordinary story, one of those stories that would write itself, filled with drama and interest, I figured, well, you know, somebody else is doing it. And then I discovered that her papers had, in the boxes in the various archives, had never been opened. was my story.
And her family was perfectly willing to let you in on that.
Her family and friends were very supportive, and for a number of reasons. I've written books about journalists. What ties me to Ethel Payne is not my race or my gender. I mean, obviously, I'm a white guy. I quip sometimes that, I ask the question, why can't a white bald guy end up writing a story about a black woman who became famous writing about a white bald president?
Right.
But what linked us was our journalism and our understanding of journalism. I knew a lot about civil rights, had written about civil rights, and of course I knew a lot about journalism. So this was really familiar territory for me.
So tell us about Ethel Payne's rise. The Chicago Defender is the newspaper that she ended up on. We're going to, later in the show, be talking about the Baltimore Afro-American. Of course, there was the New York Amsterdam News, or still is, and the Pittsburgh Courier, black newspapers that we're familiar with.
Well, these are storied newspapers. The Chicago Defender, sometimes misunderstood, is no more a Chicago newspaper than, say, the New York Times is a New York newspaper. And it played an incredibly important role in the United States. In its first years, it was circulated in the South, and it portrayed what the horrors that were going on in the South and portrayed the better life available for African Americans in the North, helping trigger a massive migration. But just to give an example of how hard that form of journalism was, if you are a black person in the South, you are not going to subscribe to the journal, to Defender by mail, because the mailman would know and the mailman would tell others. In some communities, it's actually illegal to get the Defender. So Pullman porters brought the paper South by train and left it in barbershops. And on Saturday, you could basically smuggle your copy home and six or seven people read it. And she grew up in Southside Chicago in the shadow of the Defender. I mean, Southside Chicago is an extraordinary community, as were other equal communities in Detroit and Baltimore. When African Americans moved north, they were still excluded from participating in the social life, the economic life of that city. So they created their own. Southside Chicago had its own banks, its own taxi service, its own funeral companies, its own cosmetic companies, and of course its own newspapers. And the Chicago Defender is what Ethel Payne ended up working for.
How did she get on track as a reporter? Did they just throw her into it? Did she just get thrown into it?
The famous saying that opportunity is a coincidence of luck and preparedness is really true in Ethel Payne. She was in Japan working as a service club hostess for a black service club during the occupation of Japan. And what she had been observing ended up getting used as an article in the Chicago Defender, getting her in deep trouble with the commanders in Japan, but offering her a job back in the States.
That story, if you don't mind, just briefly describe that story. It's pretty interesting.
Well, she's in Japan. It's occupied Japan. And I'm saying it's after 1948. So your listeners are saying, who know their history, well, the troops must be desegregated. Well, they weren't, because even though Truman had ordered them to be, happened to be the general, Douglas MacArthur, never listened to his boss, and he refused to desegregate the troops. So she was working with black service officers. And what she was discovering is that many of them were having relationships with Japanese women, and the product of these relationships were mixed-race babies who were shunned in Japan. And this was a big story in a lot of ways. I mean, race relationships in the United States were illegal in a lot of the states, and then the Army was completely freaked out by this. And so when Alex Wilson from the Chicago Defender came, and actually there was a reporter from the Afro-American from Baltimore who came to Japan at that moment to cover the Korean War, they met Ethel Payne. They wrote stories based on what she was telling them, but Alex Wilson was the one who brought her diaries back to Chicago. Ended up being a front-page story and getting her deep in trouble, but also opening up her career.
Oh, yeah. It showed she had an instinct for a good story.
It did. You know, what people don't appreciate about Ethel Payne is, sure, she's a first in many respects, but she also was an extraordinarily keen journalist. And just because 85% of the United States was not reading the Chicago Defender, there's no way she should underestimate her skills. I think one of the most extraordinary moments in her life is when she arrives in Montgomery, the front lines of the civil rights movement in 1955, and she's the first to perceive the change in leadership that's taking place in the civil rights movement. And she writes a line that I quote often, and if you don't mind, I'll just quote it. It's an extraordinary report. Martin Luther King at that point had not been mentioned in national newspapers. If he was, it was M.L. King. The movement is just a little tiny thing from the white main press perspective. And she reports that a new type of leader is emerging in the South. She says, he's not an NAACP worker. He's not these things. Instead, and here's her language, the gladiator going into battle wears a reverse collar, a flowing robe, and carries a Bible in his hand. This new vocal, fearless, and forthright Moses who's leading the people out of the wilderness into the promised land is the Negro preacher. 60 years later, it's easy for us to see that as historians. But she saw it from ground zero and wrote about it.
She called it.
Exactly.
Yeah. She was a motivator in the civil rights movement. Her voice, her byline became well known. She was writing about this, and Black Americans, African Americans needed the newspaper, needed these stories to get motivated.
She was informing them and thus activating. You know, one of the powers of journalism is merely lighting the dark recesses of society, triggers things. But she did engage herself in a very personal form of journalism. She's more like Ernie Pyle, writing letters back. And as a result, the paper's headlines were often things like Ethel Payne sees hate, Ethel Payne sends reports. And that was why she became so iconically important. It was a kind of deep personal relationship with her readers.
James McGrath Morris, our guest in this segment of Midday, Eye on the Struggle is the name of his book about Ethel Payne. As a fearless and intrepid Black reporter in the 50s and 60s, when white men dominated the industry and the civil rights movement was reaching a crescendo, Payne jettisoned one of the sacred tenets of journalism. Quote, "For Black journalists, particularly me, I think it made us know that we could not stand aside and be so-called objective witnesses. So I adopted a code of trying to be fair, but I could not divorce myself from the heart of the problem because I was part of the problem."
Exactly.
Quoting Ethel Payne.
And that was also something that guided me. When I set off to do this book as a white guy, I tried to think, how am I going to write this book? And I took strength from Ethel Payne's notion of fairness. My experience is entirely different than hers, but I could be fair to her. Biography is like painting a portrait. What we bring to the canvas differs, but I think I provided a fair report of her. But that was a central problem for her. In 1955, when she's in Washington, D.C., just getting a cab to get to the White House is a challenge. Restaurants barred her. There were politicians who would not speak to her because she's Black. So, in a sense, she says, I'm part of the problem because that's the language of the time. What she meant is that she couldn't divorce herself from the civil rights struggle, so every question she asked was, in a sense, a weapon for the civil rights movement. And the power she discovered, and this is this notion, it really matters who has a seat at the table. When she entered the White House press corps and began to ask questions about civil rights, the white mainstream media had to report those cases because they were being asked in a national forum. In a sense, she would help put civil rights on the national agenda. So what she would ask on a Tuesday would show up on Wednesday and Thursday in the New York Times, Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, and other papers who had not covered this issue.
She moved her base to Washington pretty much, although she did the reporting on the civil rights movement on site.
Everywhere. She's like most Chicagoans, she never gave up voting back home. But she left Chicago in 1954 and moved back only for a few years. So 50 of her almost 80 years were in Washington. But she also not only left Washington to cover Montgomery, Little Rock, all these major places, but she also connected the civil rights struggle in the United States, the Black freedom struggle, with a larger struggle, the struggle around the world. She ended up being a globetrotter, going to China when it was first opened, going to Africa 13 or 14 times. And in fact, one of the most wonderful, poignant moments is she campaigned also against apartheid. In fact, one point, when she's no longer a reporter, she goes up to the South African embassy with a cane, and you think, what harm could this little old lady do? She goes inside. She says, I'm not leaving until you change. And they had to escort her out with handcuffs. But anyway, just before she dies, she goes to South Africa to interview Nelson Mandela, who, of course, would have been a hero of hers. And what I like is it's also an explanation of her wonderful sense of humor. No matter how many bad things happened to her, she never lost that. And so there's a picture in the book of her with Nelson Mandela, and he's in his bathrobe. And she says, lots of folks got to interview Nelson Mandela. I'm the only one who did so while he was in his PJs.
Americans did get a look at Ethel Payne and hear from her on television. CBS did use her as a commentator, right?
Starting in 1972. And that was significant, not as much for the content, but for the fact that people would turn on TV and see a Black woman speaking about the issues of the day. John Ray, who became an anchor in a number of markets, Washington and New York, told me that when he was younger and he turned on the TV, he saw her, he said to himself, I could have this career. That's the kind of inspiration. She did that particularly for women. I mean, there are many newspaper women and anchors in these two markets here who got their start from her mentoring.
One of the central points you make in your book, Eye on the Struggle, is that the white community and the white press in particular paid little attention to the Black press in which Ethel Payne worked. I wanted to read this and get your comments about this. You say, not surprisingly, the children and grandchildren of African Americans from Ethel Payne's era, quote, inherited a deep suspicion of the reporting by mainstream media despite its efforts to populate its ranks with minority members. As it is the media, for better or worse, that delivers and interprets the news of the various recent and controversial grand jury decisions, mm-hmm. the selective perceptions of whites and blacks, shaped by different historical media experiences, feed their radically different interpretations of events.
I think the segregation of the media continues to have a legacy today, just like the segregation of our housing or anything else. Culture, acculturation. I am the way I am. I speak the way I am. I wear the clothes I am because of the way I was brought up. And that's true for every group, every ethnicity, every gender. The power of having two separate presses in the United States for that many years makes people suspicious of what was the other press for them. And so when I look at the New York Times or the Baltimore Sun or some paper, I think of it as the mainstream media. For many other folks, it's the white media, despite being populated by folks of different color and ethnicity and gender. And that legacy shows up, I think, in our mutual distrust or trust of justice, our mutual trust or distrust of reporting. And one of the reasons why I think a book like this is helpful is most of the folks I go to who are older and African Americans nod their heads because they know the story of Ethel Payne. In part, I want to reach other folks who don't know the story and don't understand. The two views of the civil rights movements are really different and important. The New York Times and other papers portrayed the Civil Rights Act of 64 and others as munificent gifts. And notice the words being given to African Americans. The black press portrayed it as rights that were overdue to us that we took, that we won. Really active verbs. To this day, that legacy still inhabits us.
And to illustrate that even more, earlier, and I think it was in the late 50s when Congress passed some sort of civil rights.
The 57 civil rights.
57, where there was sort of a watered down civil rights.
Oh, watered down.
And yeah. I mean, I'm being kind here and quick and brief, but, the New York Times and others, Washington Post hailed it, and she's saying, what are you talking about?
Well, right? Not only that, the world was upside down. Yeah. She was attacking Johnson and Kennedy, later heroes of the Civil Rights Movement, and the hero at that moment was a fellow named Richard Nixon.
Amazing.
I know.
Yeah.
Alice in Wonderland world, isn't it?
James McGrath Morris is the author of this book, Eye on the Struggle. Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. If you'd like to hear more about her life, more about his book, James Morris will be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library tonight at 6:30 p.m. I think, is this in Wheeler Auditorium? I have my notes
Poe.
Here. It's in the Poe Room. Yeah. Oh, you get to go in the Poe Room. So that'll be at 6:30 tonight. Again, the book is called Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. Thank you so much for being here.
Honored to be with you.
We're going to take a short break on midday. When we get back, I talk about news photography. Irving Phillips Jr. and Irving Phillips III talk about their family's 70 years of photography, three generations capturing the African-American experience in Baltimore. So please stay tuned. As part of Black History Month observances, more than 30 photographs from the Phillips family are on display at the Baltimore City Hall. The exhibit is called You and I, Henry. You and I, Henry, a journey through Baltimore and beyond from behind the lens of three generations, and it runs through March 13th. And here to tell us about it are two of those generations, Irving H. Phillips Jr. and Irving W. Phillips III.
Yeah.
Did I get it right?
Yep. Well, it's Irving Henry Webster Phillips. I go by Irving. All right. He goes by Webb.
Your father was?
Senior.
Senior. Irving Henry Webster Phillips
Senior.
Senior. You are Irving Henry Webster Phillips
Junior,
but you go by Irving H. Phillips.
Right. Okay.
That's your caption
line,
right?
Right.
That's your credit line.
Oh, yeah, that's
your
credit line, yeah.
And then we get to Webb. People call you Webb, right?
I got the name that was left.
You got the name that was left. So you're Irving W. Phillips III.
Pretty much.
Nice to meet you. I've known your father for years, of course, because your father was a photographer at the Baltimore Sun for 20-plus years, starting in the 1970s, right, Irv?
1969.
Well, anyway, it's nice to get you on the show.
You look the same, too, man.
And your father, I didn't have the pleasure of meeting your father. Your father was
You would have loved him.
I'm sorry I didn't meet him. He was a photographer with the Afro-American, right?
Yeah.
And so he was a news photographer, but he also took pictures of Baltimore life, right?
Yeah, plus he traveled during the civil rights thing. He was, Afro had Baltimore, Washington, Jersey, Philly, Richmond,
right.
North Carolina, South Carolina. So we followed King and Malcolm and all that. He's got pictures of and then when I got out the war and came back to the Afro in 67, I followed King down south and stuff till he got assassinated, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting, you know. I remember what he smelled like, you know, because it was so hot and shit, and all them little churches we went in. He would go in. What I love was, I won't ramble with.
That's okay. You're talking about Dr. King, right?
Yeah. I would like, I remember when we were in Greene County, Alabama. The first time we went there, they was trying to get him registered to vote. So Hosea Williams used to talk. Then Jesse Jackson used to talk. Then Andy Young used to talk. Then Ralph Abernathy used to talk. Then King used to talk. And they would all go out the next day and register. And they might stay there 2 days, and then they come back for the vote. And they totally changed over everything because the blacks had more people than white people, you know, in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they did it. But they really put all that inspiration into them.
So your father was a photographer of the Afro first, and then you followed him there.
Yeah.
So what years did you work for the Afro?
Oh, man.
You went to the Sun?
I went to the Sun in 69. But okay. I 2 years between the 65, 67, I went to Vietnam. I was a radio operator. And radio teletype. But then I came out and went back to the Afro. Then the Sun papers wanted to hire a black photographer, so I wound up getting the job.
Tell us about your father.
Oh, man. He was really something. He was very entertaining. And he was really entertaining. And he had a ton of energy, you know what I mean? That's the thing that got me. I don't know how he could outwork me, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I remember when Smoke brought all the mayors over from D.C. He was doing a convention, you know, one time.
Kurt Smoke.
Yeah.
The mayor.
And my father took the pictures, but he wore me out getting stuff together, you know, because we had to set it up and all this stuff and get... Anyway, he always did. He made me feel inadequate, you know. But what I loved about him was the different things he taught me about how to work. You know, like now, when I see pictures, just like I'll gaze myself with other photographers. Like he taught us Benny's mother.
You're making reference to Benjamin Phillips.
Yeah, his mother, Betty. Anyway.
Benjamin Phillips IV is also in the studio from the Afro. We're going to talk to him in just a minute.
They taught us.
So, wait a minute, excuse me. Ben Phillips, since you referenced him.
Okay.
He's a cousin of yours, right? Right,
first cousin.
Okay.
Well, anyway, his mother used to run Afro. But anyway, I remember they used to sit us down and talk to us. You know, they'd say, look, don't let the white man break your spirit and all that. When you go to a place and take pictures, make sure you take an overall. And so when we put it in the paper, people see what it looks like because they haven't been there. It was a lot of, when you take a portrait of somebody, fine, take them from toe to top because black people like to know what you look like from toe to top. Anyway, I don't want to go on.
No, I have a question about in your father's footsteps.
Yeah.
This is a question.
And that's what he taught me, all of the stuff. They were very basic things that still work today.
How did you decide to follow in his footsteps? Did you just fall in love with photography?
I wound up just loving it. He carried me around. Ever since I can remember, he used to teach me the streets as we went past, you know, the neighborhoods, white and black. He used to make me call out the streets as I saw them. And before you know it, you know the city, you know everything. And he used to always talk about people, you know, and relate it. And he was very fair and conscientious. And it was just so interesting to me, you know, just watching people and how things change. And, you know, he was something, you know. He was...
Your father also, in addition to being a news photographer, just sort of captured Baltimore life from what I see.
From the photographs that I saw,
it looked like, you know, this is what somebody looks like who's sitting on their stoop today. This is what somebody looks like while they're polishing their car or something like that, or a wagon with a pony being...
Oh, he's got all of that.
All that stuff. Yeah. Nothing posed, but just sort of everyday life, right? And did the Afro run his photographs in?
At the Sun, they used to call it weather pictures, but it was still more or less posed.
At the Sun, we called it weather pictures. Hey, let me say hello to your son, Webb. We'll call you Webb. Irving W. Phillips III. So you've been archiving these. How many photographs are we talking about between your grandfather and your father? What would you say?
It's so hard to tell. Right now, I've digitized about 10,000 negatives, 4x5 negatives. So I have those into a database that I can kind of pull from. But it's so hard to tell. I haven't even gotten through the 4x5 negatives into the 120s, into the 35 millimeters. So talking about at least upwards of 50,000 images.
Were these the property of the Afro, or did they stay the property of your grandfather?
Well, back then, a lot of the photos were housed at the Afro, and then after a while, they stopped housing the negatives, and he began to house the negatives himself. And also back then, you're talking about a time where he might go out and only have 8 to 10 shots in a day. So if you're purchasing your own film, you're purchasing cameras, it's a little different than, you know, how things work now.
What do you see in those photographs? You heard what I just said about them, but what do you like about your grandfather's photography?
Well, before I started really archiving, you know, you would see the Ella Fitzgerald playing ping pong, and you would see the Jackie Robinsons, and you would see
the Billie Holidays.
But then once you start to really going into the bulk of them, you begin to see the social life, the recreation, the backyards, the family portraits. You know, you're inside hundreds of people's living rooms, if not thousands. You're at the bar with them. Wherever he went, pretty much, I'm looking right from behind where he was. So pretty much he took a picture everywhere he went. So I've pretty much been everywhere my grandfather's been.
And to another Baltimore. Baltimore from the, what, 40s and 50s and 60s, right?
Yeah.
Irving Phillips, I posted a photograph. I don't know if it's on the Facebook page yet or not. I hope it is. One of your photographs, because you did a lot of sports photography for the Sun when you worked there. Yeah, this is the photograph. Folks, if you go to my Facebook page, you can see an example of Irving H. Phillips Jr.'s photographs from the Baltimore Sun. This is the 1 year Reggie Jackson was a Baltimore Oriole. It was 1976. And this is an autograph. This is a pregame at Memorial Stadium. And Reggie Jackson is signing autographs for these three boys. Look at the faces. Webb, can you describe that? Look at the faces of those kids.
It's the classic look of awe.
You see,
it's that they can't believe that Reggie Jackson is signing their autograph.
What your father did there, he focused on their faces, and it's Reggie Jackson's back. You see, R. Jackson, number 9. That's about all. But and look at the faces on those boys.
And that's the thing about when
you
I look
still
like,
feel it.
Yeah, I really do.
You always wonder, like, when you look in the pictures, like, now what we've been doing is we've actually started a Facebook page where we're posting a photo daily in hopes of identifying people who are in these images to try to reconnect people with photos that they might have lost from their family archives. That's I. Henry Phillips' photo on Facebook. But when you look at the kids on that photograph, you wonder where those kids at today. Like, you know, if they were to come across your Facebook page and see that image of them.
Yeah, I do.
Or if they
I
still
had the
have
same
that
thought.
Photo on their wall. And that's what we're hoping to accomplish, is to try to reconnect people with these lost photos, and also to kind of bring the history, sense of the history to the kids, you know. Yeah.
Like, he's got, through the 8 years I've been looking at his negatives, like, I remember you go through them, and, like, you see Richard Wright somewhere, and I know it's him. And then I see him 20 years later. He looks different because he had a receding hairline like Benny, but you got to picture people. And, like, that Billie Holiday picture, I didn't catch her until 4 years later. I knew it was her.
Now, that photograph, I looked at that. That's Billie Holiday on a street with an entourage around her. Yeah. People are
she's
gathered.
She's coming out of a liquor store.
And she's coming out of a liquor store with a
pint in a brown bag.
I like that photograph. It's so Baltimore,
she's
too.
She's cool. Got on Billie, a cashmere coat.
Yeah, and goes down a liquor store. Yeah. And
coming up from the Royal or wherever she was staying.
You know, the truth is that your father, because he worked for the Afro, he captured a part of Baltimore that photographers at the Sun didn't capture.
It was just, but plus everybody liked him because of his personality.
But you mentioned Richard Wright, for instance.
Yeah,
Richard Wright might have been here, and the Baltimore Sun might have had no clue that he was in town, and your father would have, right?
And like a lot of baseball players got shots of Connie Johnson, Bobby Boyd, outside our house with my younger siblings. My father would bring them over and get a meal, you know. So he was.
And
he
while
was,
they're there, get a photograph of them, right? Webb, I'm going to keep calling you Webb if that's okay. Is there a photograph from your grandfather that you could describe on the air? I know it's radio, so you got to describe it, but that you really like, that jumped out at you and said, wow, I wish I was there that day.
There's one, and I remember, if you're from Baltimore and the marble steps, you remember scrubbing steps. You remember washing your front steps until they would, you know, shine, almost hurt your eyes. And there's a photo of, there's a guy walking up the street. It's a street scene, kind of a perspective where you can just see the marble steps, you know, 20 or 30 marble steps, and you see an old woman down on her hands and knees in the middle of the photograph washing the steps. And that was actually a photograph that I was teaching a few years back at Baltimore Talent, and we actually started a documentary. Some kids had an assignment to interview the oldest member of their family, and they had heard the stories of how the city was, and they had heard the story of the neighborhoods and how the streets looked, but they really couldn't grasp it until they saw the photographs. And once they saw those photographs, that was the image that kind of stuck with them, and that's the one that I ended up thinking of. And we ended up starting a documentary that was titled "We Used to Scrub Our Steps." So that was one of the main shots.
I like that title, Webb. The exhibit at City Hall is called "You and I, Henry," is I period Henry, as in Irving. A journey through Baltimore and beyond, behind the lens of three generations. Now, what are you doing yourself in terms of photojournalism, photography?
I worked briefly back in '99 for a daily that lasted maybe a year or two. It was the Baltimore Press. And a few years back, I was doing some freelance work for the Afro. But over the last 4 or 5 years, we've just been trying to put together funding to finish the documentary that we started, and also just to finish archiving
all your grandfather and father's work.
Yeah, try to archive these images.
Irving Phillips Jr. So you worked for the Baltimore Sun. So the Baltimore Sun had a lot of your photographs, right?
Oh yeah, you know what, they used to throw them away. They would have the negatives that we put them in the brown thing.
Now they sell them nowadays, don't they?
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, they digitize everything. But I got hundreds of them. They used to throw them in the trash can in the hallway. And I remember the first time I saw them sitting there, I said, they throwing these damn things away.
I know. I picked up a couple of really nice ones.
And I picked up a bunch of them.
I picked up one. Remember Leroy American?
Yeah.
Remember Mr. American?
That's my man.
Yeah. Old Leroy.
He took the picture of Babe Ruth hitting that home run.
He has a glass negative of Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
Well, it says he's hitting a home run.
Yeah, he's really not.
May I just say, it looks like he's hitting a pop-up. Yeah. It looks like a foul ball to me.
I had to give it to American.
When you hit a home run, you don't look straight up in the air.
He never said car. He said machine all the time.
What?
And he would call cars machines.
He would call.
And he said,
take the machine down a Baltimore street.
Yeah, he said, something wrong with your machine, man.
We're talking about a man who was he became a photo editor at the Sun. When I knew him, he was like 90 years old.
Yeah.
Wonderful man. But he had thrown away one of those Babe Ruth pictures, and I said, can I have this? So I have it at home from a glass negative. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Webb, is you live in the digital age, right? The digital camera, all those negatives, all that, all those chemicals, all that time in the dark room, right? It must give you an appreciation for that.
It definitely does. I remember my grandfather in the basement and my grandmother yelling down through the vent to come up and get dinner, you know, and just not even wanting to go down in the basement because of the smell of the chemicals. And I was around for the film age for a little bit, but digital photos kind of really, really changed photography. It's like, you know, imagine if, you know, if you were a carpenter and everyone in the world had all the tools they needed to build a house in their pocket. Right now, everyone has anything they need to produce a great picture right in their pocket, and totally changed everything, how we look at photos.
Irving Phillips Jr., I want to ask you this question, because people ask me, do you have a favorite column that you've written? And I, you know, it's very hard for me to think of that because there's so many that come and go. It's the news business, right? You did this for 24 years at The Sun.
And you had a lay on something. You can bleed it and make it real, you know?
Oh, thanks.
And really stick with the stuff.
What about your photograph? If I were to ask you that question, I know it's hard because there were so many. You saw the one that I liked, the kids and Reggie Jackson and the autographs. So, I mean, what about
yourself?
That's
just like, the more, I can't believe it. That's like, I remember being up, Afro sent me down to Greene County, and I was in this lady's house up this dirt road, and King and them went to church, you know. And it's amazing, like, you know, they would bomb churches, and then they kill those four girls and all this stuff. Mm. And I said, what am I doing here? I would be down there with George Collins or Newsom. And
George Collins, who worked for the Afro, and then went to Channel 2 TV.
George used to carry
right?
his little .22 and like Mannix in the back of his thing.
I remember,
know?
George. Yep.
And I would be scared, and I said, I got to get up. I get up, go back down to the church. But it's just amazing when I think, damn, I was really there. You know what I mean? But I remember how scared I was and feeling like a chump. Yeah. And then but King, with so many things that he used to talk about, still sticks with me. Like he said, at that night down in Greene County, he talked about joy and pleasure. And I never looked at it like the way he talked about it. He said, well, pleasure was anything you can buy. You know, and you know, he would put it down. And he said, joy was what you get from people. But it was very serious, and he had the people right with him, and he had me right with him, too. And I was just glad I was there because it made a difference in my life, because I've compared a lot of different things like that, you know. And then I would think about what Betty Moss, his mother, used to tell me. They used to always try to tell me these basic things that I didn't realize. Just like, you know, people always say goodbye. When some girl you really like look at you really pretty, and she says goodbye, there's a big difference in the goodbyes, you know. You really understand it, you know. But
Dr. King, I was just going to say, you know, Mencken used to say working in newspapers was the life of kings, you know. No pun intended here, but you got to see something that a lot of other people didn't get to see, moments like that. So that's where your career took you. Yeah. You're very lucky, Irving Phillips. Yeah. Can you stick around for the next segment of the show, please?
Yeah.
Don't
not
run
gonna
out
step
of here.
On you, Benny.
It's fine. No, we're having fun here. Irving H. Phillips Jr. and Irving W. Phillips III. And that I'll tell you more about that exhibit. You want to go over to City Hall before March 13th if you want to get a look at You and I, Henry, those photographs from three generations over 70 years in
Baltimore.
And
it's in the left and right gallery.
That's
it's
right.
It's in both
galleries. Yeah. And when we get back, Benjamin Phillips IV, President and Director of Global Markets for the Afro-American Newspapers, will be here to talk about the Afro and the Black press in this digital age. So please stay tuned for that. And welcome back. As we continue our conversation about African-Americans in journalism, we thought we'd catch up with the Baltimore Afro-American Newspaper, commonly known as the Afro. The recent years have been hard on newspaper publishing, with declines in advertising revenue, print subscriptions, and efforts to regain and keep readers who get more and more of their news online. So we thought we'd check in today with the leadership at Baltimore's 123-year-old Afro-American. The Afro is the flagship newspaper of the Afro-American chain. And I note here the longest surviving African-American family-owned newspaper in the United States. Isn't that correct?
Yes,
Benjamin
that's correct.
Phillips IV. now his cat out of the bag. He's in the studio with us. Benjamin Phillips IV, President and Director of Global Markets for the Afro-American Newspapers. And that's an interesting title you have there. And it's about marketing the news, your organization online, isn't it?
Yeah. As part of the overall structure of the Afro, we implemented and we really invested in digital marketing much earlier, all of our products, et cetera. If you think of from where we came from, 13 newspapers that stretch across the South, to now we have two print editions, Baltimore and Washington, which are still our flagship areas, as well as then the Prince George's County, Maryland, which is a pure electronic edition, as well as then our print products also have electronic editions. So built on that base, we then build a number of electronic type of products that are in Facebook, with over 420,000 supporters on a daily basis. So our largest penetration, and I think we're only number two to the Washington Post in this area.
Ben Phillips, I just want to make clear, Irving Phillips and Irving Webster Phillips, they are related to you. They're cousins. But actually, you come in through the Phillips side and the Murphy side. I want to mention that the Murphy side is that goes back to the founding of the Afro-American.
I am John H. Murphy Sr.'s great-grandson.
Now, John H. Murphy Sr. was
the founder.
He was the founder. He was a former slave, wasn't he?
Yes, and also a sergeant in the Union Army.
And he founded the newspaper.
He founded the newspaper. Wow. And based on $200 that loan that he got from his wife, Martha E. Howard, he was able to begin this paper that stretched where it is.
It's interesting. The founding goes back to what? Newspapers or some kind of publications in churches?
We right? can't. Our foundation comes out of the Bethel AME and Sharp Street United Methodist Church. So the Sunday School Helper, he merged his publication with two other ministers' papers, and that became the Afro-American Newspapers.
You know, you heard earlier our first guest in this hour, James McGrath Morris, talking about Ethel Payne, but also about the black newspapers, black-owned, black-published newspapers of that time, mm-hmm. and there aren't as many now as there were then. And you heard me what I said about declining circulation. So what's the Afro's strategy? It's just more and more online. Do you think the future? You think print goes away in the future? What do you think?
I personally do not think print will go away. Our strategy is that print will not go away. We have a large segment of our community that wants the hard copy, even as we young folks of the 50s and so forth come up and we start hitting our 60s, we start still wanting to go back and pick up papers. I will say this, is that if you go to our website, afro.com, and on the left side, you'll see an archives button. And that's one of the highest areas people go in so they can go back and see newspapers back then. Unfortunately, we live in an era where it's easy to go in and you say, okay, I knew this happened, and you repeat history based on a memory. But it's a lot different when you can actually go back and see what was produced and how it was produced back in the 1920s and 1909.
I found this very interesting. I saw a comment from Jake Oliver, the publisher of the Afro.
Right. Who's also my cousin.
Another cousin. That, you know, you need to provide the history and the perspective as well. Now, at the Baltimore Sun, we have a retro feature here and a retro feature there, right? But some people think that's nostalgia, that there's no market for that. Actually, I don't know. I find young people very, very curious about the way things were before.
Well, when you go back and you actually read what happened in, say, the 1920s, 1930s, and you read a number of these stories, and you look at the stories today, and it's like, it could be like just yesterday. Yeah. It's the same thing happening, it's just a different time. So sometimes when you say you don't want to always look backwards, but it's nice to understand where you were instead of so you know where you're going.
So when you go online to any of the Afro online profiles, you see some history right there built into what's offered.
It's yeah. built in, and I guess on our 120th anniversary, we did a whole 120 print, which we also keep electronically. But the important thing is that if you look at a number of our stories today, we also try to reach back so you can see some of that history, and we repeat some of that history in that. That's particularly true when we look at photos. So when you look at the things, for instance, about five years ago with a special project with Johns Hopkins and Morgan State University, we actually worked with a number of young folks who they came up with a way to take the old photos, as my cousin said, where folks just threw away negatives.
Yeah.
We lost a lot of negatives. One day somebody just walked through and they put them in the trash because we are moving to our new building. And as a result, you lose that touch. So what happened was, what we still had the hard copies that were in our archives, which are very extensive, that overrun our Baltimore office and that are housed over at Howard and a couple other places that we're working through to get it. But they found out a way they came up with this machine that could actually, a robot that could take these old photos, bring it in, and scan those photos. At least we can start that kind of history.
Because there's so many. So you want to turn this over to technology.
You turn over technology.
So will that be available to the public?
It is available to the public. You can go online and you will see that. I'll give you the best case in point. Let's go back to the Tuskegee Airmen. During World War II, we put writers and even photographers all over the world. They were in Japan. They were in European
theater.
Afro did. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they did was that folks looked at it and said, okay, there was the 332nd. They didn't know anything about Tuskegee Airmen. So when you went into history and started saying Tuskegee Airmen, you didn't find anything until in most recent time people said, well, this is the 332nd and whatever like that. You had to know what the name of the thing is. But there are actual stories where they were followed throughout Europe because the general press did not follow them.
How does someone say Webb, how old are you?
35,
or even younger, who's, you know, standing on the street or taking the bus somewhere in Baltimore, has a smartphone in their hands. How do they relate to the Afro?
Well, they relate through what I call our digital products, where you can do the e-editions. We also do e-blasts now because we're no longer a weekly paper.
I mean, why would they turn to you?
Well, they turn to us because we have such a large following on Facebook. They get our blasts. They see a story of interest, and all it takes is one hit. And all of a sudden, we went to having 420,000, and all of a sudden you see that you have a reach for a particular story that can easily hit up to 1.2 million folks.
Well, I saw one posting that on your Facebook page, Tavon Martin's mother, for instance. Yes. I just hadn't seen it presented that way in any of the press reporting of the last couple of days on the decision by the Justice Department about that case.
Yes, and a lot of that has to do with the approach that we have today that is a little different. It says it used to be a time that the only thing you would get out of the Afro, for the most part, it had to be written by us. Now what happens is that you know that you can't be everywhere all the time. So you take the basic information and then you build upon that from the perspective that our readers want to see.
One thing I've noticed is there is local news. Yes. On the website, but it is sort of, it is global. I mean, you could be anywhere in the world and go to that website and find stories of interest to people, especially Afrocentric.
If you go to analytics at any one time, you will see hits from us all over the world. There are very few countries that do not touch us. A great example is when they talked about the Mayweather Pacquiao fight coming up.
Yeah, right. I noticed you have a lot of coverage of that.
The Philippines is one of our biggest.
So tell us about that, really.
Well, part of it has to do, if you go back into, was it 1909 or whatever, there was a riot down in Texas, and the folks down there said, telling Roosevelt, we want you to get these black troops out of the country. Guess where they sent the troops?
To the Philippines?
To the Philippines. So there's always been a connection to that. I mean, those are some of the things that go on.
The challenge for the Afro, as it is for the Baltimore Sun, other newspapers, is making money off of all those hits you get on your website, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Figuring out a way to do that.
And that is one of the charges that Jake Oliver, our CEO and publisher, and we do every day. We are working fast to bring up these new revenue streams. It's a paradigm shift, and a lot of the newspapers that refuse to embrace this technology are not going to be around. Luckily, Jake Oliver had forethought in the vision that I shared that says we will invest in this and we will be successful.
Benjamin Phillips IV is president and director of global markets for the Afro-American newspapers, and right from up the street here on Charles Street at the Afro. And he's speaking of Jake Oliver, the publisher of that publication. Thank you very much for being here today.
If I could say just one other
thing. Yeah, sure, go ahead. Right.
It's about, from the photographer's perspective, the one thing about I. Henry Phillips Sr. is that he really launched these generation of photographers, I being one of them. I can remember at 12 working in a dark room for 2 years before he would let me do a picture. But he taught us to use the technology, and he gave each of us to use our special talents in our special ways, whether it was Irvin, whether it was Irvin's brother Frank, and now his grandson. He gave us some very basics and taught us how to go out and be photographers.
And if you want to see the photographs of I. Henry, I. Irving Henry Webster Phillips Sr. and Irving H. Phillips Jr., you go over to City Hall between now and March 13th to see their exhibit, You and I, Henry, A Journey Through Baltimore and Beyond from Behind the Lens of Three Generations. And also, if you're interested in Webster's projects, Webb Phillips project, it's I. Henry Photo, GoFundMe to finish his documentary and all that archiving. So I'll let you get back to work, Webb. Thank you very much for coming
in
today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Nice to have you on the show. Irv, it's great to see you again.
Okay.
Yeah. Take care of yourself. All right. Thanks for being here. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into our midday for today. I hope you enjoyed the program. And come back again tomorrow, midday Friday. Steve Hsu, the Anne Arundel County executive, will be on the show tomorrow. And we have a special history hour for you in the second hour of the show tomorrow. So we'll see you then. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richmond, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Rogic's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.